This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 17, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Iranians head to the polls today for a presidential election. A House committee passes a bill that would cut $100 million to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we'll take a look at what debt cancellation could mean for a local community in Uganda. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. There were violent clashes in Kyrgyzstan today after demonstrators stormed and occupied the government headquarters there. 1,000 police took back the building, using tear gas and clubs to dislodge the demonstrators, injuring 39, 12 of whom were hospitalized. The protesters say they're supporters of would-be presidential candidate Irmad Barik Tabasov, who was denied a spot on the ballot in next month's presidential election because electoral officials say he has become a citizen of neighboring Kazakhstan. Barik Tabasov is widely identified with former President Askar Akayev, who fled the country during a coup in March. Acting President Kurmanbek Bakiyev is overwhelmingly favored to win the presidency next month, but election officials say the riots could complicate the election, which is scheduled for July 10th. In Brazil, a high-ranking member of the president's Workers' Party has resigned over a growing bribery scandal. Natalia Viana reports from Sao Paulo.
The president's chief of staff, Minister José Dirceu, resigned yesterday in the middle of the biggest crisis the government of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has faced up to now. On Tuesday, the president of the Brazil Labor Party, or PTB, Roberto Jefferson, told Congress that José Dirceu knew about bribes that the Workers' Party, PT, allegedly paid congressmen and did nothing. Jefferson said, "If you do not resign, José Dirceu, you will be damaging the image of an innocent man, the president." Dirceu is considered the right arm of Lula, and he was one of the most influential ministers in the government. A Datafolha Institute poll released today shows that the scandal has not affected Lula's popularity. 36% of the interviewees rated Lula's government as good or excellent. The rate was 35% 50 days ago. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Natalia Viana in São Paulo, Brazil.
By an overwhelming majority, the House of Representatives has passed a measure requiring the United Nations to undergo what the bill calls major reforms, or have the U.S. annual contribution to the UN cut by half. The White House opposes the measure, and its fate in the Senate is still unknown. Iraqi solidarity activists are training their sights on the war reparations that Iraq is still paying to Kuwait. Heder Rizvi has more from the United Nations.
Hans von Sponeck, a German who served the UN as its humanitarian coordinator in the 1990s, said today the Iraqi government should negotiate its debt directly with the Kuwaitis. Sponeck had resigned from the UN in 2000 in protest against the continued sanctions against Iraq and their devastating effects on the civilian population. The UN has approved about $52 billion in payments to companies and individuals in Kuwait by using a part of Iraqi oil sales. Talking to reporters, Voices in the Wilderness leader Kathy Kelly said the people of Iraq have suffered and endured so much, from sanctions to bombardment to occupation. They are innocent people who haven't done anything wrong. A UN body is due to meet in Geneva by the end of this month to approve the final claims for compensations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
We'll have more in Iraq later in this newscast. Myanmar's pro-democracy opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi turned 60 this weekend. Supporters will be marking the date with protests in 13 countries demanding that she be released from house arrest. And they'll be bolstered by a statement from the Nobel Prize Committee, which has taken the unprecedented step of asking the Myanmar government to release Suu Kyi, who has won the Nobel Prize for Peace. Selena Masuda has more from Washington.
Aung San Suu Kyi has spent 16 years behind bars or under house arrest for campaigning against Myanmar's military government. Her party won a 1990 election, but rulers of the country, which was known as Burma at the time, refused to hand over power. For Jeremy Woodrow of the U.S. Campaign for Burma, the global protests are significant.
In the mid-1980s, Nelson Mandela was not a known quantity to the American public, but there was a huge effort in 1988 to demand his release when he was turned 70 years old in prison called Mandela at 70. And we're taking a page out of that campaign and calling this effort Aung San Suu Kyi at 60 to help the world know who she is.
Democratic Representative Tom Lantos of California will lead today's protest in front of the Embassy of Burma. Lantos is the ranking member on the House International Relations Committee. Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
There were two separate attempts in Congress yesterday to force the Bush administration to address withdrawing U.S. forces from Iraq. Neither attempt seems to have been successful, but it illustrates a growing discontent in Congress regarding the war. But as the debate over pullout from Iraq heats up in D.C., the Iraqi people themselves are taking a more cautious wait-and-see approach. Eric Klein has more.
House Republicans blocked debate on a bill introduced by Democratic leader Representative Nancy Pelosi that would have required the Bush administration to report to Congress on, quote, a strategy for success in Iraq.
There's nothing in their performance that would lead us to believe that they have a plan and that they have a plan for success. They certainly haven't shared it with the Congress.
Pelosi sought to force debate on the issue as an amendment to the $428 billion Defense Department appropriations bill, which calls for $45 billion more for the Iraq war. At the same time that Pelosi's amendment was rejected, a separate bipartisan resolution was proposed, which called for the Bush administration to develop a plan for withdrawal of all American troops from Iraq beginning in October 2006. Analysts do not expect this resolution to get very far. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said that an artificial timetable would send the wrong message to the terrorists, the Iraqi people, and U.S. troops. The Pentagon's Director of Operations, Lieutenant General James T. Conway, echoed the White House position. Speaking on behalf of the commanders of U.S. forces in Iraq, he said they would not welcome an artificially imposed deadline.
They have their plans, a plan for victory, and forces will be withdrawn when victory is accomplished between U.S. and Iraqi forces. If you look at it from the insurgents' perspective, they know our history, just like we study them, and they see where we have withdrawn previously, in Vietnam, in Beirut, in Somalia. And nothing would make them happier, I suppose, than to think that there is a deadline out there.
The reaction to all this talk in the United States of a full troop withdrawal from Iraq is very different on the ground there. Saad Radi is a teacher at the University of Baghdad.
There is a difference between what I wish and what I want. What I wish for is that the Americans leave Iraq till the last soldier and leave Iraq for Iraqis, whoever they are. But what I suggest, which is more reasonable, since America is in a quagmire, so they had to withdraw the troops, even by starting with withdrawal to their bases, which is not a real pullout, but it's a start.
With some Iraqis looking for any sign that the American occupation of their country may someday end, and American officials resisting talk of deadlines and timetables for withdrawal, there does seem to be some movement on the ground in Iraq towards that end. Pentagon officials say they have trained and equipped 160,000 Iraqi security forces, and work is being done to hand over the civilian government to Iraqis as well. But some people in Iraq are extremely skeptical of this handover. Mohammed is a security guard in one of the Iraqi ministries.
This exit plan will be faked, and they started planning that now. At the conference attended by all of Iraq's ministers, the first thing in the discussion, the Americans told the ministers that they had to have an American counselor in every ministry, and that those Americans have the authority to alter any structures of those ministries, even the pre-war structures. And these American counselors are to be employed by the Iraqi government. When anybody would come to ask us later why the Americans are still a part of Iraqi government, they will say, no, they are employees of the government, so it's a local issue, not an occupation. But the Americans will have the authority to run the ministry more than the minister will himself.
The Iraqi government is currently working to draft a constitution for their country, which could be voted on as early as this December. The Bush administration is rejecting all calls for a clarification of what their plans are for Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Iranians headed to the polls today for a presidential election. Out of the seven candidates, all who were cleared from a list of over 1,000 candidates by the powerful General Council, it is unlikely that any one will get the 50% needed to win. A runoff is expected between former Higher Education Minister Mustafa Moin and moderate cleric Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani. We're joined on the line by Free Speech Radio News correspondent Saida Jamshidi in Tehran. Saida, polls have just closed. What is happening in Tehran right now? Did a lot of people come out to vote?
Basically, what's going on here is that there are two types of people who are considering their vote. Those who would like to cast their vote to the favored candidates, and those who really would not, I mean, do not have any consideration of voting for any kind of candidate. So basically, the first type of people who would like to vote, they are two groups again. Those who, and basically what I just understood out of my observation and my interviews with people, these two types of people are those who basically have to vote in Iran, in Iran's ninth presidential election. They are young people who need to secure their future in order to do that, they have to vote because they need that stamp, that red stamp on their birth certificate to show to the government that they they are part of the political system, and then doing so, they can get the allowance to go to the university or to more secure jobs.
Now, you were talking about young voters. 1.7 million voters will go to the polls for the first time in this election in Iran. Did the candidates have to listen to issues that were important to young people in this election?
Yes, actually, this one is a very important question because, as you know, Iran has about 67 million people, and half of this population are under age 25, and about 1.7 of them are students who are first-time voters. And I mean, because they are very new in the political system, and because they are unexperienced people, candidates can influence them. And I mean, more easier than the rest of the population. So they can just talk with them and give so many promises. And I have very strong doubt at how much they can carry all of the promises they make, because the last president, Khatami, basically had a very bad experience of delivering his promises. And Iranian people are very skeptical of any kind of promises that any of the candidates make.
Saida Jamshidi is Free Speech Radio News correspondent based in Tehran. EU leaders have been meeting in Brussels the past 2 days for the first time after France and the Netherlands rejected the draft of the EU Constitution. Confrontational budget talks among the European Union's 25 national leaders deadlocked, and hopes faded for reaching an agreement on how much each member should pay into EU coffers and how the money should be spent. A number of EU leaders demanded that ratification of the Constitution should continue, while many countries postponed their ratification process until better times. Raphael Kraft reports from Paris.
There were only 4,000 yesterday demonstrating in the streets of Paris while presidents and ministers of European countries were meeting in a summit in Brussels. Chirac should resign and listen to those against the EU constitution, demonstrators chanted. The demonstration was called by the left and extreme left-wing parties and trade unions that campaigned against the constitution last month. Yves Salès, at the head of the left-wing Copernic Foundation, explains the purpose of the demonstration.
It's to say again to all the European governments what is the meaning of the French vote against the European Constitution. It's not, of course, a vote against Europe, but it's a vote against a Europe which is only, the only purpose is market, business, and not the human needs.
Europe should be more social, they all claimed, while the EU summit in Brussels was trying to find compromises after both France and the Netherlands rejected the draft of the constitution. The differences were high between a weakened France that dug in its heels on farm subsidies and Britain clinging to its rebate on its contribution on the EU budget. This breakdown seemed to satisfy Olivier Besancenot at the head of the Revolutionary Communist League.
Those who said the rejection by French people of the EU constitution would make the ultra-liberals happy are wrong, as they are getting divided today. The powerful and the leaders are getting divided while those opposed to this draft are getting stronger.
Besancenot and other left-wing leaders opposed to the constitution believe the French and Dutch referendums will have a domino effect in other European countries where people or parliaments haven't voted yet. Yves Salès explains.
Since this vote, we have a lot of messages of all countries where people tell us that they want to have the same debate that we have had here in our country. And we propose that there will be a general European debate about what we want to do with Europe. And this idea is increasing now in all the countries.
A number of EU leaders, including Mr. Juncker, the President of the Commission, French President Jacques Chirac, and German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, cried that ratification must continue. European leaders convened, time to restore public trust in the EU is necessary. Yves Bertoncini teaches international and European relations at French Political Sciences School.
It was said already 10 years ago, and it's kind of a slogan, you see. Well, yes, you have to make Europe closer to citizens. I totally agree with this, and I think many citizens agree, because they think it's too far, it's too complicated. But if there is a strong political will from the heads of states and governments to impose political and institutional changes, it could lead to many positive changes. For example, I said to the European Parliament more powerful, the Council of Ministers more open, more rights to citizens, etc., etc.
Denmark has already indicated that it may, like the UK, call off its planned September referendum, while Poland and Sweden might also delay ratification. But few answers or actions are currently visible on the horizon. On the contrary, it may be hard to prevent an impression that the EU is unraveling. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
The G8 agreed to a $40 billion debt cancellation last week for the world's poorest nations, including Uganda. But many wonder what the debt write-off means for impoverished local communities. Joshua Kilimpa reports from Kampala.
Uganda has a population of 26 million people according to the 2004 census. The country's debt totaled $4 billion. This poor East African country was paying over $200 million annually to service the loans before the G8 approved a $40 billion debt cancellation. Uganda's Minister of State for Finance in charge of planning, Isaac Musumba, says the money saved from the debt relief will be invested in certain sectors crucial for national development.
Up to $3.6 billion that has been on our books from multilateral lenders will be waived. The annual interest repayments that we've been making can then be kept and become part of our budget for expenditure. So this money, it means, will be utilized in other areas within the economy, like education. From universal primary education, we probably will move to universal secondary education as well, and things like that.
In all, 18 nations were offered debt cancellation, 14 of them in Africa, and eventually a total of 38 nations with 552 million people may receive full debt relief. News of the debt write-off in Uganda was received with a sign of relief, but some analysts argue that writing off debts and allowing struggling nations to apply for new loans could spark a new cycle of dependence, especially if there are no mechanisms to monitor the money. The Anti-Corruption Coalition of Uganda a consortium of civil society organizations fighting corruption in Uganda, have issued a statement saying mechanisms to fight corruption should be strengthened if the debt relief will have a positive impact on the economy. Henry Muguzi is the information and communications officer for the group.
It's a positive move because debt is a burden. And you know, we are poor because of that external debt, and we are convinced that if the resources that are spent on servicing those debts are brought back into the economy to work on sectors that are pro-poor, then we can have a remarkable improvement in the economy. Let debts be relieved, yes, but let there be effective utilization of resources that are saved from debt cancellation. Why? Because as long as there is corruption, we are not bound to get any benefits. We shall accumulate much more debt. I'll give you an example. From 2000, HIPC 1 and HIPC 2, Uganda was relieved of that external debt up to 2000. Now, from 2000 to today, we've been able to accumulate the debt to the tune of 4 billion.
For the poor nations, the deal is expected to save them a total of about $1.5 billion in debt payments each year. If $1.5 billion, which will be saved, is spent on education, healthcare, agriculture, and infrastructure development, poor countries like Uganda may be able to jump out of perpetual poverty. However, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has said debt cancellation should also be followed up by better trade terms for Africa. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chalimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The U.S. and Indonesia signed an agreement yesterday to reschedule the payment of $212 million in debts in order to free up funds for the rebuilding of the tsunami-ravaged areas of Aceh and North Sumatra. The amount is part of debts owed by Indonesia to members of the Paris Club, which groups 19 creditors. Indonesia is one of the highest indebted countries. Out of a $272 billion debt, about $48 billion is owed to the Paris Club alone. And some are wondering if debt rescheduling will have a true positive impact in the reconstruction of the tsunami-hit area. From Jakarta, FSRN's Maggie Margiono has more.
Dian Pramaswari, the director of INFID, a non-governmental forum for debt monitoring, says that debt rescheduling will not make a real impact on Indonesia's financial situation, nor significantly contribute to the reconstruction in Aceh. Furthermore, the rescheduling could further destabilize the country's economy in the future as it continues to accumulate debt. Dian calls for a different plan.
Kalau misalnya mau menolong betul, real menolong dan memberikan manfaat bagi
If the creditors wholeheartedly want to help Indonesia, they know that most of the infrastructure in Aceh has been destroyed, so they should cancel the debt that was incurred by the construction of the destroyed buildings.
Most of the infrastructure in Aceh was financed by foreign loans, and much of what had been built was destroyed by last December's tsunami before the debt was paid. Again, Dian Pramaswari of the NGO Forum for Debt Monitoring.
Kalau misalnya mau menolong betul, real menolong dan memberikan manfaat bagi
If the creditors wholeheartedly want to help Indonesia, they know that most of the infrastructure in Aceh has been destroyed, so they should cancel the debt that was incurred by the construction of the destroyed buildings.
Since the tsunami hit Aceh last December, at least $400 million have been committed as fund pledges to aid in the reconstruction and rehabilitation of Aceh. But only a tiny portion of the committed money has been paid. That's why the rehabilitation stage that should have started this past March has been postponed until next month. In addition to these financial difficulties, corruption is now on the rise. About $80,000 of the emergency fund is not accounted for. Ridaya Laode is coordinator of Coalition for Aceh Fund Monitoring.
It is not clear where the $80,000 are or who holds the money. Even after the state auditor granted one more month to the Minister of Welfare for the completion of the financial report, the minister was not able to account for a half of the $80,000.
Some nation states will not pay the committed tsunami aid if the government does not manage the fund transparently. At the same time, the Asia Development Bank is setting up its own independent auditor to monitor the projects financed by the institution. For FSRN, I'm Arlette Cohen, reading for Maggie Margiano in Jakarta, Indonesia.
The chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee says he's confident the Senate will restore some of the funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting above the $100 million cut that a House committee passed last night. However, if the House's version of the bill were to be adopted, it would result in a significant loss in the budgets for most public radio and television stations. The cut is part of a spending bill that also contains significant reductions in the No Child Left Behind program. Mitch Jezerich reports from Capitol Hill.
The House Appropriations Committee voted last night to cut the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's budget by 25%. Potentially affected networks include Pacifica, NPR, and PBS. Republican Representative Ohio Ralph Regula, who chairs a subcommittee that made the recommendation, says that there are over $2 billion in cuts that the budgets for health, labor, and human services will face, and that public broadcasting will have to take its share. Regula says that such public broadcasters as PBS could turn to marketing to make up the difference.
Yeah, they'll do a couple of things, like Sesame Street gets a lot of money from sales of Big Bird and so on, and likewise, they'll probably take it more to the public. I watch quite often CPB, and I notice that they have periods of public solicitation, send your money and get a recording of Lawrence Welk or the Boston Pops or whatever it might be. And I believe that they will make adjustments accordingly.
Another provision of the bill that would have phased out all funding for public broadcasting by 2008 was rejected.
This is the most valuable resource we have for getting decent quality television to children.
Representative David Obie of Wisconsin is the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee. Obie says that the cut would be specifically tough on public television.
And then when you see that they did not provide funding for the cost of digital conversion, you are forcing local broadcasters to face up to a 46% cut in the funds that they receive to keep their operations going.
The entire House of Representatives will vote on the measure next week. If passed, it is expected that the Senate would restore some of the cuts.
If I got bothered every time I saw something the House did that I disagreed with, I'd be constantly bothered.
Public broadcasters may have one powerful ally, Republican Thad Cochran, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee and whose father once chaired Mississippi's first statewide public TV authority.
This has been very beneficial for education purposes. People will have access to these programs that might not otherwise have the benefit of the instruction that's provided or the learning experience that's made available to them. So I'm hopeful that the Senate will be able to restore funding to levels that will enable the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to continue providing this valuable service to public radio and television stations around the country.
It's likely that the friends of public broadcasting in the Senate, including Republicans, will restore much of the money that the House cut. But the message the GOP is giving PBS in particular is clear. Play ball with us politically, or Big Bird is going to end up as a chicken fricassee for tomorrow's dinner.
Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. He says public broadcasting is being affronted on many levels, including a move by the chair of the CPB, Ken Tomlinson, who reportedly is considering to appoint former co-chair of the Republican National Committee and high-ranking official at the State Department, Patricia Harrison, to oversee the CPB.
I mean, the idea that you would have in the chair of CPB and in the president of CPB, two people whose principal interest is in promoting propaganda, in promoting the official U.S. government, in this case the Bush administration line, is outrageous and is a clear indication of the kind of direction that the GOP wants to take public broadcasting.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.